Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll reach back in time to honor the late great jazz pianist Sir George Shearing with an interview I conducted with him on October 14th, 1983. Stick around.
Hey, did you know that you can listen to the latest Mr. Media on your phone with the Stitcher app? Stitcher is smart radio for your smartphone. Mr. Media is on demand and on the go with Stitcher. Download Stitcher for your phone today. Get the free download at Stitcher.com. That's S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.com.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. You know, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Stop by and check it out. There are more than 700 archived celebrity interviews for your listening pleasure. The show is brought to you today by thepartyauthority.us. Planning a wedding, mitzvah, or corporate event? For any and all occasions, call the Party Authority nationwide at 1-800-DIAL-DJS. That's 1-800-342-5357, where one call does it all. Mr. Media is recorded live from the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. When Sir George Shearing, the composer of Lullaby of Birdland, died on Valentine's Day 2011, we lost one of the great pianists and gentlemen of jazz. Born in London, in 1947 he came to the United States, where he was known far and wide for his work with singers Nancy Wilson, Peggy Lee, and Nat King Cole, as well as his many collaborations with Mel Torme. Later in his career, he was recognized for his concert appearances with Marion McPartlin and Billy Taylor, which introduced him to entirely new audiences. I had the great honor of interviewing Sir George for the St. Petersburg Times way back on October 14, 1983. I knew he was a great pianist because I listened to his albums. I learned he was a great gentleman when he treated me with kid gloves as I awkwardly, and somewhat ignorantly, asked him questions for more than 30 minutes. As you listen to this nearly 30-year-old recording, please focus on George's answers and not to my questions. I was barely 18 months out of college and knew very little about jazz. But George was great. I had to keep reminding myself not just of all he accomplished in the music industry, but that he did it all without his sight. He was, for all intents and purposes, the pale British version of Ray Charles. Anyway, this interview is one of my all-time favorites, and I'm so glad it survived the years with just a little digital boost in spots. I hope you'll enjoy this Mr. Media Lost Tape featuring Sir George Shearing.
Hello.
Good afternoon. Can I speak to Mr. Shearing?
Who is this?
This is Bob Andelman.
Can you tell me what it's about?
Sure. My name is Bob Andelman. I'm with the St. Petersburg Times.
Ah, fine. Very good.
I'm sorry.
This is A, Bob.
Oh, how do you do?
Fine.
Catch you in the middle of lunch?
Just about, but you had an appointment for this time, and it completely slipped my mind. So go ahead.
All right, well,
if you don't mind me continuing eating while...
Not at all.
it's not the most polite thing to do, but...
That's all right. I'm
not on radio, so go ahead. You had an appointment for this time, and completely... go ahead.
Well, that's all right. First of all, looking forward to seeing you down here. I was only recently introduced to your material, being, I guess, a little young. But I've been reading about you all week, and I've been fascinating, to tell you the truth. You've had quite a career, and are having quite a career.
Oh, yeah.
I guess the best place that I'd like to start is to ask you about your play with Marion McPartlin. You recorded an album together about a year or so ago,
mm-hmm.
How far back does your performing with her go?
We met in this country.
Hmm.
Several years ago.
Uh-huh.
But unlike anyone else from England, where you think that we would meet in England and come over here and continue our friendship, it wasn't that way. I don't remember meeting Marion in England.
Hmm.
But, now being English, we have no language problems.
Right. How old were you when you left England?
28.
28. Mm-hmm. Oh. So it's not like you were a teenager who, you know, what I'm thinking is if you were, you know, 17, 18, the chances of the two of you meeting would be less likely. But at 28, I guess it would have been possible.
Well, I will say that when I came over here, it was a lifelong dream come true.
Hmm.
Because since a teenager, I wanted to participate in the American jazz scene so badly I could taste it. You know. So, when I set my foot on New York soil,
right,
that was exciting enough. When I went down to 52nd Street and sat in with some of the guys, that was even more so. And I had my own group in Carnegie Hall with Dizzy Gillespie. I mean, good grief.
When was the first time you played Carnegie?
1949.
Mm-hmm. That was quite a big year for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was the birth of the quintet, and September in the Rain, and moving from the poverty line on up. Hundreds of things happened during that year. Right.
Well, let me see. How old were you in 49?
Well, I was born in 1919, so I would be 30.
So you're about 30 years old. So you'd been here 2 years, and that's a pretty fast rate of movement. How much?
It really is. In those 2 years, of course, there was a considerable amount of impatience because I met so many American jazz musicians during the war in England who said, man, you know, you should really go to the States, man. You kill them over there, you know.
Hmm.
So, of course, I came over to the States and I didn't kill them over here.
Well, not for 2 years, maybe.
I didn't have any great personal identity. I came over here with ability to play like many of the great jazz pianists at the time, but I didn't have any identity of my own until the formation of Quintet.
Right. Now, the thing I noticed is that many of the critics and the writers, the critical writers, let's call them, point to 1949 and you as being the time that they... Now, I noticed some difference here. That most of the writers credit you with responsibility for the Lockhand style, for bringing it at least to prominence, if not to...
I think I did bring it to prominence. I know I did not invent it because there was a guy named Milt Buckner.
Right.
Playing with the Lionel Hampton Band in the mid-40s. It was the first one I heard playing Lockhand style. But he played it for blues, you know, rather than full of ballads. The reason I brought it to prominence is because I used the Lockhand style to play things like Roses of Picardy and I'll Remember April and stuff like that. And my very quiet sound came at the end of a rather frantic bebop era.
Uh-huh.
And so I guess it was a welcome change.
Is it? I hope you'll pardon my ignorance on this, but is the sound of you playing in the Lockhand style, is that something that needs to be witnessed, or is that something that I could hear if I were listening to it?
I think you'd hear it.
Well,
on almost every quintet recording.
Oh, I see.
No, I'm not using that too much anymore. After 29 years, I had enough of it. I felt in the end that I was musically in prison.
Mm.
Because the demands made on my creativity were less because of the necessity to confine myself to that style.
Right. I imagine that had come full circle from the beginning when the quintet had probably offered a greater depth.
Yes, that's right. That's right. The the quintet offered a greater depth at the beginning and total confinement by the end. And it did. It came full circle. It's a very good analogy.
I'm trying.
Very good.
When going back to 49 again for a few minutes, some of the things that I read and that were pointed out were that you were one of the quintet was one of the first to make the vibes a very major voice. Is that a fair?
It would be probably more correct to say that the quintet was the first instrumental combination to find a perfect blend between the vibes, piano, and guitar.
Ah, very good. That was my next question was about the guitar, but I see how that all fits in. Yeah, very good. And
For God's sake, don't forget the guitar today, because everybody and his brother plays guitar. Barely run up against. Are you a musician? Oh yeah. What do you play? Oh, I play guitar. Everybody plays guitar.
Was that the case in 49?
What?
Or do you mean today?
Today.
Now what about in 49?
Well, it was more my era, so I have a little bit of prejudice about it. But I could understand the language. You're a musician. What do you play? I'm a pianist.
Uh-huh.
Now, it would be, I play keyboards.
Oh, right. Okay.
I'm a tenor saxophone, but I'm a saxophone player. Well, you still hear it today, but you're going to hear keyboards and guitar much more than you saxophone and trumpet.
Yeah.
But of course, there's still a bunch of them around, obviously, thank God.
Well, I'm very grateful that there's still saxophone around. It's one of the things I have a great preference for listening to is a good sax player.
Again,
it's just something to that.
Come a little closer and speak a little louder.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. How do you feel about the move to the keyboards and the electric pianos and the organs?
Well, I'm talking about trying it from the point of view of color. But
mm-hmm.
if I did, I know one thing I would lose would be my touch and my approach to piano, which is very personal and very delicate and, you know, may I say, somewhat artistic, you know.
So, mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of interesting things going on. You know, weather reports doing some marvelous things.
Mm-hmm.
I've never really made any attempt to ride any bandwagon. I sit and listen with enjoyment to some of the things that have been done, and a great deal of it is trash, and some of it is music.
Mm-hmm.
If the present electronics are used sparingly and judiciously, then you can get some marvelous tone colors out of them.
So you would...
If they're just used for noise and volume.
Mm-hmm.
This is my greatest criticism with music today.
Okay.
It is all too damn loud. You know, I wonder how many deaf people we will have in future generations because of the horrendous assault on the ears. It's a shame, you know. I guess it started because they play great big mammoth places of 17, 18, 50, 55, 75,000 people. It would seem that be necessary to, but if the same people came in to play a $5,000 or $6,000 seater auditorium,
mm-hmm.
they would still have all that volume screaming.
Yeah,
and that would be giving no attention, paying no attention to the acoustics of the room.
Mm-hmm.
Even with us relatively non-amplified people, we try to govern our performance according to the acoustics of the room. It's very important.
On the same subject of the electronics, would you prefer, you know, enough people are using an electronic piano or an electronic organ, mm-hmm. Keyboards, what have you.
Yep.
Would you see that they would be useful as accessories to a piano as opposed to hoping that they would not overwhelm piano?
That's right. You know, if they're used judiciously to give more tone color. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. Nothing wrong with it at all. I'm very fond of it. So
That's what I would kind of expected. One of the things I read was that you had modified the sound of the quintet a few years into the operation with you added the African Cuban rhythms and some other things and just tonal coloration and what have you, which you almost have to do, I guess, after playing a certain form or
mm-hmm.
for a while. On the subject of the quintet, the quintet played for 29, 30 years?
Yeah.
Is that?
I had a quintet for 29 years.
Ending about 78?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
The, now, you were, from what I read, you were very adamant that the quintet would not get back together again for just the reasons you just told me. And yet I read that in 81, a rather well-known Italian singer conned you into putting it back together.
When the quintet broke up, I said that there would never be another quintet unless Frank Sinatra or Standard Oil wanted it.
Or Standard Oil?
Standard Oil never came through. Sinatra did.
How did it come about with Sinatra? Had you played with him before, or?
No, he just asked me to play 2 weeks in Carnegie Hall with him.
Oh my!
And a week in Boston. And it was a wonderful experience. You know, I mean, the guy is still a miraculous performer. What can I tell you?
Was the Let me see if I don't have my notes right in front of me on that. Was that the quintet played before Sinatra or played behind Sinatra? You didn't play behind Sinatra, though. Right. Okay. Were the performing members of the quintet the same as they were when you had broken it off in 78? No.
I didn't use any previous quintet member.
Oh, I see.
Purposely, because I didn't want anybody to say, gee, why didn't you use me? Why isn't... Then there's no hard feeling.
Right.
What do I do? I've had, I don't know, 7, 8, 10 vibraphone players, 3 or 4 bass players, you know, 3 or 4 drummers. You know, you can't do it. So the best thing to do is not to use anybody.
Right.
From previous winter.
That was a one-time thing. The quintet has not been back together since then. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. Maybe it was almost concurrent with Sinatra. You began working with Mel Torme, or is that after?
Mel and I did our first concert maybe 5, 6 years ago.
Oh, was that long? I didn't realize that.
For the Newport Jazz people.
Ah.
And then we gradually increased the amount of work. We just made our third album.
Oh, your third? What's the name of the third album?
I think it's going to be called Chase Me Charlie, because we made it at Charlie's in Georgetown. It's a jazz supper club.
In Washington?
Yeah, Georgetown, Washington.
Huh.
And, we just appeared there for a week. Smash business, you know.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Hold on 1 second.
Sure.
I'll be right back.
Sure.
Okay, my wife's finished grinding the coffee.
Real good.
Mm-hmm.
Successfully navigated lunch, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm glad. Oh, we were talking about the third album.
Yeah.
The
We did it live from Charlie's. Probably be out in the spring. Mel's drummer and this marvelous bass player with me, Don Thompson.
Don Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Beautiful bass player.
Now, is that the gentleman that has been playing with you?
He's been with me for about a year. No, the guy who's been with me for is a guy named Brian Torf.
Right.
He's getting his own thing together, you know, now.
Oh, I see. Right, the only one I was familiar with was Torf. I didn't realize that you had changed.
Thompson is, he is on the second album that Mel and I just released called Top Drawer. And not only is he one of the top two or three bassists, but he gives me a lot of trouble on piano, too. So many times when we do our act, we have two pianos.
Hmm.
And he puts down the bass, and we end the show with two pianos.
Oh, boy.
Quite a spectacular thing.
It sounds real interesting. So he'll
he's a Torontonian. He's from Toronto. Well, he's living in Toronto now. He's really from the west coast of Canada.
I see. So, of course, he'll be with you when you get down here, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. The work with Torme, has that been among the greater commercial successes that you've had album-wise or performance?
Not only among the greater commercial endeavors of my life, but probably my greatest singular artistic experience.
Hmm. That's quite a mouthful. Especially for a man eating lunch.
Mel Torme.
Sorry.
Mel Torme plays piano. He's not my favorite pianist. Not his favorite singer. He arranges, plays drums. You know. So he's a very multi-talented man.
Hmm.
He's a writer. He writes songs. He writes books. Multi-talented man.
Is it, it must be rather pleasing to, after, 35,
yeah,
going into your fourth decade of performance, I guess,
mm-hmm,
to be as successful and popular again after so long, whereas some people would be hoping just to find a place to play.
Yeah, I've always got much more work than I can handle. Always. I turn a lot of things down. Because I've just passed my 64th birthday.
Oh, happy birthday.
I think it's time to enjoy the home a little more.
Oh, does that mean you're going to cut down a little bit?
Yeah, just a little. My wife always laughs when I say that because she doesn't see that I am cutting down. She would like to see it. She's a musician. She's a classical singer.
It seems I read that.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a lot of reading the last few days. How long have you been married?
1975.
She
doesn't play bridge quite as well as I do.
But then again, Mel Torme doesn't play piano as well as you do.
That's right.
Actually, let's go back and talk about Marion again and talk a little bit about the show coming up. It seems at the moment the third player with you is kind of up in the air, as we understand it. We were told in the last couple of days that Teddy Wilson is evidently fairly ill.
The third player is Billy Taylor.
Oh, that's confirmed now.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Teddy is in hospital with bleeding horses.
Ooh. Well, I guess we're on the right track.
Went out to Toledo, Ohio, and did a date to cover for him. He had a date there.
Well, I imagine that you must go back good ways with him as well. As
he was one of my great influences in earlier life. He was one of the guys that I first learned to play life, as it were.
Hmm. And we're talking about Wilson now, correct?
Wilson.
Teddy Wilson. You had performed a couple times in this three piano setup with Miss McFarland and Teddy Wilson. Have you ever had the same formation with Billy Taylor?
No. I've known Billy for a lot of years, and I've never had.
Have you ever performed with him?
I think I've been on the same program with him, but not performing together.
I see. What kind of things do you expect to be doing during your solo? Well, solo you yourself and Mr. Thompson,
well,
I guess.
In the second album with Mel, Don and I do a thing called "Away in a Manger," which is an English setting to the Christmas Carol.
Mm-hmm.
We'll probably do that. I know we'll do a composition by Sonny Rollins, who's a fine saxophonist and composer, called Olio, which features Don, very fast-moving bass segments. It depends somewhat on how much time we have. You know, when there are three people involved in one concert, and then you play together, I leave it fairly flexible until I get down there, so we know what kind of time we have and how we can pace the show to fit into that time slot.
Right. I just want to check something. Olio, is that O-L-E-O?
Margarine, I guess.
Same as, right, okay. And it was Away in a Manger?
Away in a Manger.
Okay. When was the last time that you played in this trio situation? Three pianos?
Months ago, a year ago, I can't really remember now, but it's been a while.
All right. What took place when the three of you took the stage? What was this?
Same thing that will take place down there. We'll pick a tune, and we'll just kind of jam on it.
Just
we don't work these things out at all.
Hmm.
These things come off the top of our head. It never worked out.
Let me just take a look over my notes for a moment.
What may surprise you is that if I have time to do so, I will probably sing a song that I wrote maybe a few months ago. It's called Caught in the Middle of My Years. It's kind of a nice thing because it's a poor guy who's still got a lot of energy and doesn't know which way to turn and who's going to share it with him. He ran alone, he won his race. World can see the rewards that he has for that, but what's a prize of any size when there's no one there to share it with him?
Sounds kind of sad.
I say myself, it's a very nice ballad, and it has a very reflective and very philosophical lyric written by an acquaintance in San Francisco, his name is Bob England. Writer. It's not known at all, lyric writer. Actually, the first song, in a way, that I'm bringing to the attention of anybody since I wrote Lullaby of Birdland in 1952.
Mm.
No, everybody tells me I'm a composer, and it's time for me to prove that I deserve that.
So you have laid a little low as far as...
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. I'm a performer, you know. Primarily, but there's no reason why I shouldn't get into the world of composition.
Lullaby Birdland gave you, it was, as I understand it, was a rare bop success. It was a real commercial hit as far as bop goes.
It was written as a theme song for a 6-hour-a-night disc jockey show, which Birdland sponsored. And I wrote it in 10 minutes. I always tell everybody that I wrote it 10 minutes and 35 years in the business. Because you can't really toss a song off in 10 minutes unless you've got a huge knowledge of what you're doing and can draw on it.
Partially, I guess, as a result of the success of that song, jazz musicians, a lot of them seem to have a problem with success. A jazz musician who's successful is suddenly either sold out or is too commercial or not pure.
You see, the jazz makes no pretense at necessarily being a show. I mean, jazz is a style of music, and you get some people who go up there and just say a minimum amount of words. It used to be worse than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to play some How High the Moon. And so now they play How High the Moon for about 15 minutes. And then they'll maybe go into another song without saying anything in 10 minutes, you know. Very soon you've got 45 minutes gone by with a lack of communication with the audience and maybe three or four songs. I guess part of the reason for what success I have is I've always tried to pace myself, never play two or three ballads together, communicate with the audience, talk to them, crack some terrible corny jokes, and try to make a show out of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise you might just as well have a group of people in your living room just play for fun.
Otherwise you might as well buy the record.
I can
relate to that. That's my, as a paying customer, that's my attitude. If I'm not going to see something, you know, to a greater or lesser degree, there are always exceptions.
Right, go home and listen to records.
Yeah, if it's going to cost me $15-$20 to come out and see something, I'd kind of like to see something. For that $20, I could buy two or three of your records.
That's right.
And I could enjoy you from now until I'm not able to enjoy you anymore.
That's right. Are you going to be at the concert?
Yes, sir.
Oh, well, come by and say hello.
I will.
What's your name again? I'm sorry, because Joan told me this. And
That's all right. It's Bob Andelman.
Andelman.
Right.
Yeah.
Bob is good enough.
Yeah.
Right. I understand you also be, during the day that you're here, you'll be taping a television program.
Yes, we will indeed. it's a... Yeah. It's a public television thing, you know.
Right.
And we'll all be on it, all three pianists.
Right.
It's actually part of a classical series.
That's Counterpoint, isn't it? Is that the name of the program?
Right.
Right. I met the producer a couple of days ago. She was in town setting things up. Yeah, Ruth Leon.
Ruth Leon, right.
Yeah. Very nice woman.
Yeah, she is. She's very bright.
It was quite a coincidence, too, that she was putting that together with Billy Taylor, and he was...
We had a long conversation this morning. She's really very knowledgeable, and she's got some very good ideas about...
She spoke very, very highly about you and Marion the other day when I spoke to her. She was in town here 2 days ago.
I guess I got to get back to the office there.
All right. Well, it was a pleasure to get to meet you by phone, and I appreciate your time.
All right. My pleasure.
Come
by and say hello. Let me know you're there.
I will do that.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Sherry.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
For more original interviews with your favorite musicians, surf over to our main website, www.mrmedia.com. Subscribe to Mr. Media on iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. Just search Mr. Media Interviews from within iTunes and subscribe for free. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many locations. If you've got a comment on today's show or would like to advertise on Mr. Media, email me directly at bob@mrmedia.com. That's mrmedia.com. You can also follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, twitter.com/Andelman, or on Facebook, just search Mr. Media Interviews. Thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate you sharing a piece of your day with Mr. Media. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Vanessa Williams. There's so many things kids have to be good at these days. It's hard to stop and think about how something like learning music can help them in the future. Music helps kids because it's a performing art, and children need to learn to perform well so they can succeed in society. Getting an 85% on a math test is pretty good, but hitting 85% of the right notes during a concert isn't good enough for most music students or their teachers. A special kind of practice and preparation goes into the discipline of performing music, and it helps kids develop habits that will allow them to perform better in all areas of their lives.
A PSA brought to you by MENC, the National Association for Music Education, and the National Anthem Project, the campaign to restore America's voice through music education. March is Music in Our Schools Month.